Hello, and welcome to Mondays on Tuesdays podcast. I am your host, Firecrow Silver Knight. My project that projects is Compare Basic, and this episode is about identity and identity collapse, how the overcompensations somewhat explain the world we are in. For the first time, I am going to say down with capitalism, and I'm going to talk about why, and why it was such a hard thing for me to come to terms with as someone who really likes money, not necessarily having spending money, but the concept of earning money, and how. I'll talk about my trials and tribulations as a talent-driven employee, and this will be really, really interesting. I hope you can hear the sort of compassion I have for all sides of this situation. And I know, you know, both sidesing has a bad name, and it should. But there are very real reasons why our capitalist workforce is structured the way it is. And there are also some very, very bad, unrealistic expectations that should be let go of. And I'm going to try and talk about both of those things in the context of my story, kind of what's happening. So I'll start by saying that my recent story is that I have gone through a bout of extreme poverty, switched industries from a high-paying industry to a low-paying industry. But more than that, I've gone through periods of unemployment and disconnection that I have never experienced since I started working in about 2004. And boy, do I have some insights from that. I'll start with a somewhat jokish parable, which is, I think we've all heard the, you know, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day, teach him how to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. But the joke that I have is, if you take a fish that a man has just caught and beat him with it, with the expectation that he will catch more fish, no one wants to eat that fish that you've just beaten him with, and he still doesn't actually have the ability to catch more fish. So we have an economy that is horribly structured around fear, and this is a very strange thing to present, but I am experiencing the positive aspects of that this week. And the reason is I way overestimated what I could sell with Compare Basic and spent the winter trying to code up something that would either raise money through inspiration, through crowdfunding donations, or sell something. And very much struck out because I couldn't connect what I was doing to what people needed. And falling behind on bills as badly as I did scared the absolute crap out of me. And so I went back out into the restaurant industry with more commitment to have the problems that I solve and the labor I provide connected to the economy than I probably ever have had. You know, I've had a very privileged, joyridey software career where I could walk across the street and grab another job. I've never really taken financial hardship seriously. And when people say things like, make sure you have savings for a rainy day, I get that now. And so this is kind of the driver of our social economic construct, is the idea of scare the absolute crap out of people so that they become workaholics. And for me, there is actually a level of responsibility of, you know, spend money carefully, make sure I have the hours I need. And so I will, you know, tilt my hat to the idea that there is some positivity there, but I'm now going to talk about the nasty side of it that I think we all can see. It's the second week of having full-time hours and sitting at home coding all day and then jumping into 25 to 30 hours of restaurant work has not been an easy transition, and I knew that. And yesterday, at the end of my shift, I was so exhausted that I dropped something in the most embarrassing way. I took a plate of food that had been cooked and set it down on the counter where we place the food on top of the bell that people use to ring for customers to see if we're in the booth. And it fell, it knocked over a glass bottle, and I had to clean up the mess. And this is the kind of thing that is the nasty side of the fear-driven economy that we have, is that people end up pushing themselves past limits and do ridiculously stupid things. So positive and negative sides of that. I'm going to talk a lot more about more of these sort of identity concepts when we're back for the break. And here we go with the musical intro from my teenage years. All right, so the topic of this is us or all of us. And it's kind of a play on the phrase us or them. And one of the things I would absolutely say about what we're seeing in the economy today is the idea that to certain people with extreme wealth, it definitely seems like democracy or community participation or what is good for the population, the world is kind of a side note. It's kind of like, I got mine, don't care if the world burns. And the reason I'm playing on this us or all of us versus us or them is the idea that that mindset of us or them only works when there is a varied economic ecosystem that you can, rape, pillage, and take advantage of. And the analogy I'll use is what if you were a bank robber? What if you were a, pretty good bank robber? And then robbing banks became very common, and you started showing up and the vaults were already empty because, man, there's just so many bank robbers these days. That's an idea of an occupation that works when there's only a few of you. And so I think what we're seeing now is companies engaging in extractive practices where sort of the business community at large is designed to do what I call orange squeezing rather than value building. So it's like they take over a company and they squeeze it for efficiency, and you take some company that already produces a product or service that has a lot of value, and you basically just make it more efficient and extract more value from it and then move on. And rather than the transformative process of discussions with your staff and your customers and problem solving and, how does every dollar the company takes in become two? It's more like, how does every dollar the company takes in stay at one and the operational expenses of that dollar go from, 50 cents to 45 cents to 30 cents, and so profit's higher, but you're still only taking in that $1, right? And this extractive method of business only has value if people are doing the hard work of starting businesses and the hard work of innovation and the hard work of transformation. And if that breaks down, you end up in a situation where this sort of class of elitist MBA, Ivy League university trained, sort of consultant reliant wealth class is quite literally running out of oranges to squeeze. And so, hey, layoffs happen en masse, and everyone's scratching their head saying, why isn't it working? Well, it's not working because the bread and butter of the economy is creation. It's not sales. It's not, it's creation. And if not enough stuff is being created, then there's, this extractive model that can work if it is a fringe group, does not work if it's, the majority of the business world. So I'll talk a bit about what that does, but first I'm going to talk about what kind of person wakes up in the morning and says, I'm not going to make things better, I'm just going to take something that exists and squeeze it. And I talked very, very early on in an episode about the idea of the people who have believed that an honest living is impossible. I do actually have some sympathy for them because can you blame them? So my life as a software engineer was a, show up at 9:45 for a 10 a.m. first meeting and then, clock out at, 5:45 or 6 and go home and get paid $200,000 a year. That was my life as a software engineer. And I have always been a talent-driven employee, and I cared very much about the quality of the code base and the, trajectory of the company and whether we were building things that could have been better. And I was also somewhat selfishly unconcerned about combative problems on teams where I talked about an idea that nobody wanted to build. And that was a very immature oversight of mine. But I now am in the very opposite area of the company, the economy, where I'm getting paid what would be considered in certain states in America minimum wage, but in the state of Iowa on the federal minimum wage, it's actually, considered pretty good. And I have to work, a physical job that is exciting. I love cooking. I love meeting customers and, making them happy. That basically means that I'm seeing the other side of the economy where just surviving is a challenge. And while I derive tremendous strength from the purpose and meaning of work, and I have a history of suicidal behavior, and so I quite literally cannot survive if I don't have enough purpose. There's an actual, dragon chasing me that I must satisfy. But I can understand if the comfort of sort of the white collar software life that I had was not available for someone to realize, I can't hack it with the economic opportunities available to me. I got to find an investment opportunity, some way to cheat, some way to be an advantage that I can have a comfortable life and a comfortable life to my family. This whole honest work thing is not real anyway. People have been mean to me in the past. I may as well become one of them. Let's go. Here is the case for advantagism. And I would say this, as horrible as it is, can you blame people for wanting it, given how hard things have been? But what I will say here that's really, really, really interesting to me is that the reason it's so hard is because it's been so hard. And if we let it be harder, it'll get harder. Meaning, if fair pay and a real creative economy does not arrive, we can see poverty deepen and the inspiration for advantagism deepen and the endorsement that advantagism is okay in the upper echelons also deepen. So time to reset. So I have always been a talent-driven individual. Of the many things I am good and bad at, figuring out how to do things well and in a way that makes people say, "Ooh, that tastes really interesting," or "Ooh, how did you do that?" Or "Wow, how did you get the computer to do this?" Or "Wow, how'd you make that music?" That's always been a strength of mine. A weakness of mine has been doing or knowing things that are obvious to other people. I at times can explain to people how the combustion engine in their car works, how electronics works. I can find insights for human behavior, and people just say, "Whoa, thank you for explaining that. I've been kicking that around for a while, and it didn't make any sense." And then the conversation will drift to some celebrity people know about, or some super normal thing, I don't know how to use an application on their phone that's really simple. Like for a very long time, people were able to do things in Google Maps that I could not figure out. And so I have this sort of idiot genius, thing going on, and it dates back to my. Remember, memory serves. It dates back to when I was the only member of my fifth grade class, I believe, fifth or sixth grade, who could not memorize my times tables. And they just passed me on. They said, "Well, we tried. No matter what we try, he just doesn't get it." And I really didn't get it. And so it was very obvious to me at a certain point that while people praised me for the 3D animations I was making on my computer, the short stories I was writing, there was no praise for my academics. I didn't like school, and so I dropped out. And I never went to college, even though I was accepted to a Emerson College in Boston for largely for my portfolio of interactive stuff. When I never went to school around 19, I decided, yeah, no, I'm actually not going to do this. I went and got a GED just so I would have some certification. And I have a hilarious story about the time that my GED credentials were actually checked. So I went to New York. I sort of bootstrapped my career by doing administrative temp work, which was kind of like I called it administrative business a palooza because I was just sent to offices that needed, a crisis worker to fill in the administrative gaps of filing papers and answering phones. And then I got into software and my GED credentials were checked for the first time when I was hired by Haven Technologies, which was a division of Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance. They were going to pay me $135,000 a year And they did for a very long time. There was a generous bonus on top of that. And I had been a software engineer for 8 years. And that was the first time my education credentials were officially checked because their HR department said, "We're just making sure you were honest in your application." And I was like, "Honest about what? I didn't list my education anywhere." They're like, "Yeah, but we just have to verify your credentials." And so I, from a very, very early age, I decided to be talent-led. And what that meant when I parachuted out of software is that my Swiss cheesy resume did not get me any pivot or white collar job. And the industry that did get me back to work was restaurants because I could show up and figure out which dishes needed to be soaked and how to structure the sort of stack up of the plates or cooking dishes or prep dishes and get them through the dishwasher. And as long as I could figure out how to manage my posture so my back didn't hurt and how to get things through the machine and stack them and understand how the line works so I could restock the dishes on the line without bumping into people, even though that did happen a few times early on. I was in, right? Restaurants and software are industries where talent can lead in advance of resume experience. And I can say firsthand how challenging it is in a modern day economy to be talent-led. If you were to wonder why the efficacy and performance of modern companies seems to be just falling out of the sky, a whole bunch of nonsense, people have a hard time innovating, all that kind of things. I think one answer is the friction I have experienced by being someone who really does not care about the status of someone talking to me, really does not care about the sort of traditional way things were done at a company, really has no interest in anything other than the performance of my role and the performance of the company. It definitely makes sense that people would get the message that they should be a ass kisser more than a performer. It definitely makes sense that people would get the message that advantagism is more valuable than actual engagement and delivering of service and quality. These messages are received, and it is very obvious why. And what I would say about, the reason I'm finally saying, down with capitalism is because for me, being a talent-driven employee, I have always loved the mechanics of how things work, how flavors blend when cooking, how solvents and moisture can loosen the sort of crud on dirty dishes, how everything from combustion and then more recently electronic motors of magnets cause spinning within electric cars, how the basic mechanics of a software language works, and then how the basic mechanics of accounting works. I mean, accounting is fascinating, very different than finance. And the basic idea is in accounting, you actually frame the motion over time through a perspective lens. It's not all just hard numbers. It really is a how do you analyze a situation to make sense of it? And that's fascinating to me. And from an accounting perspective, there are a lot of things about capitalism that do make sense. The idea that people can pass money around seemingly autonomously about what they can do to transform raw materials and raw time into higher value. How they can make decisions about who to hire and who to support and who to promote and who not to. That all makes sense when you think of capitalism because you're talking about an engine that can be a method of accounting, kind of accountability for good, for positive change, for people to plug their passions into the economy. But the problem is that capitalism and accounting are not the same thing. Capitalism and money are not the same thing. Capitalism is the idea that whoever has the biggest bank account gets what they want. And that's a problem. Because just because you have a big bank account does not mean that you will make decisions to have a bigger bank account. Let's take an example. How many of us know musicians who release an amazing album and then they release an album that is crap? Well, what if we considered their reputation from their first album as unchangeable over time? This sounds a bit like the career of someone who runs a great company and then sells it and then goes around destroying other companies. because they're in that period of their second or third album that's crap. It's analogous to, musicians who do this, and I want to call attention to two groups that had around 20-year hiatuses and then came back with fantastic albums. The first group, I'm going to call out and poke a bit of fun at my good friend and crowdfunder Matt Arnold, is Blink-182. So Blink-182 is known for, kind of poppy, somewhat watered down punk things in the 90s. She said, "Don't let the door hit your ass," but then they released an album recently, and it is just wonderfully deep and interesting. There's this one song that goes something like, "Tragedy, replace my honesty. Now I can see this dark rain." Oh. And it's really interesting and amazing. And they came back after about 20 years of not really releasing albums to do this amazing thing. And the same thing happens in business. You do see people who have like dark periods where they don't really do a whole lot of stuff, and then they come back. But the problem is, if status and reputation is based on the idea that once you're awesome, you're always awesome, then we are going to endorse a lot of, a lot of bad things. And so one of the challenges that we have with capitalism is the idea that if you make a bunch of money and have a big bank account, and we consider that as the reason for taking your advice, we're ignoring the human condition, which is that talent is a transient thing. It's not something you're born with and you flip it on like a light switch every day. It must be polished, it must be maintained, and it will go in and out. And what I know, as someone who has always been told by many people that I was a genius and then kind of poked at for being a dumbass, I spent the first 8 years of my career definitely fumbling through the ability to write effective software. And it was only really after about 8 or 9 years that I started really sort of clicking, oh my God, okay, here's how the functions align, here's what the computer can do and will never do, and that kind of thing. And I would say the similar thing for something I sort of tried and never really got that amazing with, which was breakdancing. I was always like sort of a not as good breakdancer as everybody else doing it. And I never really was able to polish it into something that I was, proud of, even though, any breakdancing is pretty impressive than none. And so a lot of the spaces that I would do them at, as I got older, is basically like once in a while at that circle that forms in a wedding. People were massively impressed, but I never was. And so I know firsthand that unpolished talent doesn't mean anything. And, cooking, I'm kind of in a funk where my home recipes are like almost good but not amazing because I'm experimenting with things like, curries and sauces, and I was modifying a vodka sauce to be tomato based but not with cream, and trying to use the chemical properties of alcohol, particularly vodka, to extract flavor from onions and shallots. And it was all right, but there's something about the bitterness that arrives from the vodka flavor that is balanced out with the cream, and I was, unable to make that work. I will make it work at some point because I'm a very tenacious, obsessively experimental guy, and I will come up with some crazy, crazy alcohol extraction based recipes. But it just goes to say that without innovative development and an understanding of inconsistency, status-led and privilege-led things don't really work in enough cases for them to have the weight they have. So capitalism has very much made two huge, huge, huge problems. The first is assuming that once you have a big bank account, everybody should listen to you is pretty ignorant of the human condition, which is that, everybody has bad days, if not bad decades. And the other problem is that being a talent-led person with a talent-led career and understanding how much it has cost me to stick to my guns on no, things should be done well, it doesn't matter who can do them well, I definitely understand why we have a business culture that has made that toxic enough that enough people say, eh, fair work, honest work, not on the cards. I'm gonna find a shortcut. And that's very sad. And I don't endorse that. I think it's horrible, but I have compassion for why people feel that way. And I would finish with something pretty simple, but pretty kind of a nasty commentary on our world, which is, I believe the ideal society should deprioritize certain things about humans. And here's what they are. Laziness, greed, addiction, and violence. Now, to the best of my knowledge, we live in a society that very much discourages laziness, very actively discourages laziness, criminalizes violence, and criminalizes certain addictions, mostly related to controlled regulation of substances, alcohol, hard drugs, tobacco. But it doesn't really do much for sort of intangible addictions. Workaholism, I joke that it's the addiction that still pays you a lot, but still takes away everything else, takes away your friends, takes away your marriage. And it doesn't deprioritize wealth addiction or food addiction and or starvation addiction, which is something I struggled with a bit. And it also does not touch selfishness at all. We give selfishness a free pass. Here's what's interesting. I would reorganize that list to be this way in order of things that are results and things that are causes. I would put violence at the top of that list. I would put addiction below that. I would put laziness below that. And I put selfishness at the very, very, very root of this toxic tree. And the reason is, if you are selfish, you are much more likely to be lazy because you don't see the benefits of taking care of things in advance at personal sacrifice. It's going to cost you something to get out of bed, but once you are out of bed, you can have a bit more fun. If you are lazy, you are much more likely to fall behind in your energy levels, in your happiness levels, and then engage in massive, you know, indulgence while you try to catch up. And so being lazy and being subject to addiction, I think, have a relationship. And then addiction and violence have a relationship, because if you are compulsively addicted to feeding your emotional wealth in a way that you can't intentionally decide to do, those addictions can absolutely lead to violence, and they do. And so I think we have this like societal model that's not touching the root of human behavioral problems, which is selfishness. So to wrap up the episode, because the subject of us or all of us is this idea of us or them only works in the privileged time when a lot of people are producing a lot of good things. There is a great economic ecosystem, and it is thereby possible to be, you know, the bank robber that robs banks. Not that I endorse that. But what I'm trying to say right now is that it is not even possible to behave badly economically in our time, because there are just too damn many of you doing it. there's, you know, it really is a time to like knock it the fuck off and start paying attention to the talent of the companies we have and start rebuilding, you know, companies with new talent. As always, if you're interested, I have more material at comparebasic.com. And yeah, have a really kick-ass week. Not for me, for you, because yeah, we all need some wins. And I'll see you next time.